Hello and welcome to the Politico Nerdcast, where we bring you inside the stories of the White House and geek out on the amazing circus of American politics. It's Thursday, December the 15th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, your host. Here are the numbers that mattered this week. 36. That's the percentage of respondents in a CBS poll who say Trump will be a poor president. 69, the number of Democratic electors demanding an intelligence briefing. And 4, the number of 2018 Senate races already affected by the Trump cabinet shuffle. Grab your calculators and enjoy the Politico Nerdcast. Here we go again. Hello, Ken Vogel.
Hey.
Hi, Charlie Mattesian.
Hi, Kristen.
Hello to Scott Bland.
Greetings and salutations.
All right, let's get to our first data point. It is 36. That's the percentage of respondents in a CBS poll who say Trump will be a poor president. Just 34% of Americans believe Trump will be a good or very good president. So we're talking about roughly half the level of enthusiasm that people had about Barack Obama in December of 2008. Charlie, what impact does something like this, does this level of unpopularity have on Donald Trump as he enters office?
Well, I think at one level it has no impact at all, because why should he care about what the polling says
when
much of it turned out to be wrong also and turned out to be off the mark? And if you don't believe in polling in the first place, or you only acknowledge or believe polling that validates your own opinions of yourself, does it really matter? I don't know. But I do think it could have an impact on his legislative agenda, because the more popular you are, naturally, the more capital, political capital you have to spend. And I think the moment that members of Congress recognize the bloom is off the rose, members are emboldened to fight back. Because at this moment, I don't think there are a heck of a lot of Republicans that would be willing to buck their newly elected president, especially knowing the support he has among a certain wing of the Republican Party. But the one thing that's important to keep in mind is that his numbers are still incredibly poor among Democrats. And from what we can tell from early post-election polling, it suggests that many Democrats are not willing to give him a chance in the same way that they were willing to give, say, George Bush a chance. And so that means a lot of Democrats are going to dig in against him. And then I would just make one other point, which is Trump's really unusual in terms of his numbers, in that he's not going to get a honeymoon in the way that other presidents have, in the way that Barack Obama did, in the way that George W. Bush did. He is a guy who's been in a very narrow polling band since the moment he came down the escalator to run for president. There aren't going to be big ups and downs, no highs and lows for him the way there are with other presidents.
I do wonder, though, whether Republicans in Congress are going to interpret these kind of poll numbers in the same way that they would have in previous administrations coming off the election that we just had. Are they not also doing the same thing that the media is doing and casting a lot of doubt on the numbers themselves, when clearly the American voters are not really being fairly represented in these surveys?
Well, I think there's a couple things on that. I mean, first of all, it's not just Republicans, it's Democrats too. And Charlie's right to point out that, you know, a lot of the kind of honeymoon approval bump that new presidents mm-hmm. get is from kind of getting the benefit of the doubt from the other party, which Trump is not getting right now. But in the Senate in particular, where, you know, any of his legislative stuff is, a lot of it's going to need 60 votes to clear a filibuster, the pressure of the 2018 elections that are going to be coming up, the particular Senate seats that are coming up, fall heavily on Democrats who are from states where Trump is probably quite popular right now, where he won by significant margins. We're talking Joe Manchin in West Virginia, John Tester in Montana, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. And so, you know, I think some of these kind of national numbers for Trump that aren't so great are going to be blunted a little bit, certainly in terms of his work with the U.S. Senate, by the fact that a lot of the Democratic senators under the most political pressure right now are from states where Trump did quite well.
I think it's going to make it easier for Democrats to come out and oppose him and aggressively oppose him. I mean, let's not forget, Obama came in with those lofty approval ratings and at least outward support from some Republicans, but privately, Republicans were planning from before he took the oath to go after him. If you remember, there was a great anecdote in Robert Draper's book about a meeting at the caucus room where Mitch McConnell and a number of the Republican leaders in both the House and the Senate plotted on how to oppose Obama from day one. McConnell later famously admitted in 2010 that his number one goal was to make Barack Obama a number one, one-term president. So that's a guy who came in with super high approval ratings. You have Trump coming in with much lower approval ratings. I think it gives not only Democrats but Republicans, emboldens them to oppose particular parts of his agenda. But the other side of the coin is, let's not forget, like, looking at some of the potential flashpoints, and we're going to talk about Rex Tillerson later, but like over Rex Tillerson, over Russia, over, you know, Russian sanctions, investigation into Russia on the hacking, there are a number of the lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, who were kind of signaling that they might give Trump a hard time. They, you know, Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, they were ones who very aggressively came after him during the primary and ended up dialing back their opposition in the general. So even though they might have reason to think that these poll numbers would suggest that they would be sort of safe politically in opposing Trump on particular issues, they have not necessarily shown the backbone to stand up to him.
I think Kristen's point is important to keep in mind, the idea that members will not pay very close attention and will have a great deal of skepticism about poll ratings for the president in a way that they haven't done before. I think it's important to keep that in mind. But what we will see, I think, after about 100 days in, is that members, even if they're not paying attention to the polling numbers because they don't trust them in terms of the president's popularity, they will know. I mean, these folks have the most finely tuned political antenna in the world. Say what you want about members of Congress, but they know what's happening in their districts. I mean, they're out there, and they will know 100 days in what kind of traction he's getting, and 6 months in or after the first year, they're going to know, and they will act appropriately.
When you look at some of the other polls that have come out, there was a Gallup poll, for example, on people's opinions about the transition. And we saw roughly a 50-50 split in terms of how Americans are viewing Trump's transition performance. You know, and that has to be everything from the choices he's making about who's going to fill out his cabinet to some of the initial statements that he has made. So far, so many of them have been related to Russia. What do you make of that 48-48 or 50-50 split we're seeing?
I think Trump has two directions that he can go. One of them is going to be what I consider to be a Ronald Reagan model, where there's lots of folks on the left that viewed him as, when he came in, you know, maybe as a little unhinged or dangerous. They weren't sure what to think about him. And over time, he won them over and ended up generating a great deal of warmth among folks who were very skeptical about him when he came in. Trump has two directions. He could either go in that direction. I suspect he will not, just based on the way he's operated in the transition. And if in the event that he does not pursue that Reagan-esque path, then we see a hard-nosed, sharp-elbowed 4 years of just total war all the time, because it's total polarization all the time.
Let's get to the next data point, because I want to talk about the confusion about what's happening in the Electoral College right now. That data point is 69. It's the number of Democratic electors who are demanding an intelligence briefing regarding foreign intervention into the U.S. presidential election. What we're talking about is Vladimir Putin and the Russian government and the allegations that Moscow was involved in the hacking of the DNC and the hacking of John Podesta's email, and what effect that might have had on this election. I'm going to turn to all of you, because I think this is a big issue. First, though, Charlie, who has been editing this story from Kyle Chaney, what is the state of play here, and is it really significant?
I think it's significant anytime you see that many electors expressing some degree of reservation about the president of the United States. It's unprecedented that we would have so many electors going public with their concerns. We just haven't seen it in the past. Lots of electors, I'm sure, have hated the fact that they were casting their electoral votes in a losing cause, or they hated the nominee of the opposing party, but they've never been so public. And the fact that so many Democrats are coming out by each day, that list has been growing this week. And it really tells you something about the polarizing nature of Donald Trump's win, and also the way he won. But I think that the caveat here, though, and the reason I don't know that it's getting that much traction, particularly among Republicans who are not supporting them in any way at all, and it's because, number one, the issue raises grave questions of about the legitimacy of the next president. And there are lots of Republicans who may have concerns about these so-called Russian ties or the idea of the depth of the Russian intervention in the election. But at the same time, they do not want to bolster the Democratic cause because they believe that Democrats are doing this for partisan purposes.
Scott, is Donald Trump not going to be the president? Is there any chance of that?
It doesn't seem like it. No, it would be the most surprising thing that happened this year, but not by much, right? So I'm asking this question in all seriousness, though.
Like, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm concerned about the responsibility of journalism that suggests that Donald Trump might lose in the Electoral College vote. The likelihood of that is as slim as possible to zip, right?
Yeah, this strikes me as more of a messaging strategy than a strategy to deny him the presidency, right?
It's also, I think, fits into a pattern where at each step we sort of look to the things, the unlikely possibilities that might stop Donald Trump. You know, when he was surging in the polls, we said, well, you know, in the Republican primaries, it's going to be the real activists, the party loyalists who vote, and they don't like Donald Trump. And then he ran off a string of impressive primary victories and appeared poised to, or actually had clinched the number of delegates needed for the nomination. And we said, oh, but at the convention, you know, the party loyalists, the party establishment will take over and snatch it away from Donald Trump. And that would prove that proved not to manifest itself in reality. And so here we have yet another example where we're like, there's a possibility that maybe the Electoral College will deprive Donald Trump of the presidency. And I think all of these things fit into a pattern that is driven to some extent by just the shocking nature of the way that Donald Trump has turned political convention on its head and the difficulty that some people have had sort of coming to grips with the way that this complete outsider turned all these sort of bits of conventional thinking and political wisdom on their head and is now poised to be sworn in as our next president.
I've had to think about this a lot because I've edited this series of stories and, you know, in the process of greenlighting these stories and editing some of these stories, you know, the question has come up a lot about whether they're newsworthy in lots of ways. And in the end, you know, I come down on the side of they're incredibly newsworthy because this is really unprecedented. And when I say unprecedented, I mean unprecedented in American history that you would have this level of resistance coming from within the Electoral College. And, you know, just put aside for a moment whether it's partisan bitterness or not. It is happening. We know that there are efforts afoot within the Electoral College, even if they're coming from the Democratic side, to try and thwart a Donald Trump presidency. And so, you know, we have to report those out. I mean, that alone, I think, tells you something about the nature of the divide right now. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, I weigh in on we want to prepare people in the event they do see a high number of electors doing something uncustomary.
Yeah, certainly. If there are a large number of faithless electors, I mean, not even a large number, just a handful of faithless electors would be something that would be notable and go down in the history books as significant. And so it definitely warrants the attention. I think that where it might end up proving more significant and the folks who sort of take the long view of this are, you know, who have for some time challenged the Electoral College as being like anathema to the like fundamental tenets of American democracy, you know, one person, one vote. They see this as potentially giving them momentum in a larger push to challenge the Electoral College, which I also think is an extremely unlikely heavy lift.
I think there is a lot of sour grapes. Let me just say that right now. There's no question. There's tons of Democratic sour grapes going on here. But at the same time, you can't deny that there are also legitimate concerns that are being expressed by a lot of these Democratic electors, not just constitutional concerns they have, but also concerns about the role that Russia played and lots of questions that have not been answered yet.
Let's talk about Russia. Ken, you suggested a data point. I want to focus in on it. It is 2.6. That's the percentage point decline we witnessed in Clinton's average in the 5 days after Jim Comey's letter to Congress about new evidence in the FBI email probe. So we're not talking about WikiLeaks. We're not talking about the Clinton Foundation. There is, in fact, no similar dip around any particular WikiLeaks story. Ken, what do these numbers tell us about the Democratic argument that the Russian hack of Podesta or the DNC is what tripped the election?
Yeah, I just don't think that there is any evidence of that. I cover the WikiLeaks stuff. I was a part of the DNC WikiLeaks. I covered the DNC WikiLeaks.
You certainly were.
And then I covered, as much as I'd like to forget, and then I covered the John Podesta WikiLeaks. And I saw a lot of things that I thought were significant. And I took a lot of heat from Democrats who were suggesting, even at the time, that I was being manipulated by Vladimir Putin to write these stories and that they were not newsworthy. And I said, it is true. It raised a lot of questions about how we should treat, stolen information and whether we were getting manipulated by the way in which these documents were being released. And I said at the time, it said on this podcast, that I thought we were being manipulated. Nonetheless, there were things that I thought were very newsworthy in there that shed light on the way that the Clintons operated, that frankly cast doubt on some of the things that they had told me personally and others about the Clinton Foundation and their political operation. That said, none of those stories popped in a major way that drove captured the news cycle for a significant amount of time and actually manifested itself in a change in the polls. There are a couple of real to be sure points here that Democrats cite, and I think are rightfully so. The idea that all the journalistic firepower that was devoted to going through these WikiLeaks documents could have been otherwise spent looking at Trump or looking at, Trump's conflicts of interest or other stories that might not only not be negative for Hillary Clinton, but might be negative towards Donald Trump and therefore positive for her. Also, potentially the cumulative effect of all the coverage over the course of weeks and weeks and weeks may have had an impact and may have shaped the polls at the margins, though we didn't really see it in a sort of causal way like with some of these other stories. And then lastly, this idea that we've heard from folks, including David Brock, Clinton loyalists, including David Brock, that the Clinton campaign sort of mishandled this and they might have been better served by ignoring the emails and attacking the press or Trump for his ties to Putin. And that the way that we covered this, the way that this story unfolded sort of threw her off her message. There was definitely an effect. I just don't see any evidence that it was determinative.
Well, I think the Democrats' argument is probably a tad more nuanced than just, some email was dropped out of a Russian hack that affected her poll numbers XX percentage points. I think that what they're referring to is a general feeling that was pervasive over the course of the 3 months leading up to Election Day that she couldn't break free of the emails, that there were things that were hiding and lurking that we just didn't know about. And all of that was fueled by the drip, drip, drip of Wiki.
Yeah, but let's also not forget. Yes, that's a valid point. And I take that point, and I think that's where we see the sort of the overall effect, even if it's not traceable to a given story, that it could have sort of increased her untrustworthiness numbers and the like. Now, there were a number of there was a parallel sort of drip, drip, drip of emails that was being released by the State Department and in response to Freedom of Information Act lawsuits from conservative watchdog groups, including Judicial Watch and Citizens United. Those were also pretty damaging. And this email story was pretty damaging before WikiLeaks. So it sort of fed into stuff that was already proving to be problematic for the Clinton campaign. And to me, only reinforces this idea that it was not a singular influence that we can trace to
Vlad.
Right, to Vladimir.
Scott. Yeah, I think that was actually a really interesting point, Ken. You could watch it happening in real time when the Podesta emails or the DNC emails were coming out, that people were conflating them with, it's like, you know, Hillary Clinton's personal emails and the X thousand that were supposedly missing or destroyed, you know, for whatever
30,000
purpose. 30,000, yeah. And
which Russia would be rewarded mightily if they were to be able to find.
That's right. And that was Donald Trump's last press conference, right? Up to this point, where he said exactly that.
If people didn't have serious questions about her trustworthiness to begin with, or serious questions about her penchant for secrecy, none of this would have gotten traction. To me, the bigger story, and the one that I'm obsessed with now, is this New York Times story about the Russian DNC hack.
Yes.
I can't believe that that is not just dominating the news cycle in a to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, if you haven't read that story, you need to stop everything right now and devote the time necessary to read all 8,000 or 10,000 words or whatever it was.
You can finish our podcast first.
I mean, it's fantastic. It's not only as a journalistic enterprise, but it's also incredibly scary and should be scary to every single American. This story was, just from deconstructing it as an editor, it was airtight. They put serious, stellar reporters on this, and you could tell from every line that every bit of attention to detail was put into this product, and it's a frightening story.
I've never heard Charlie dispense such lavish praise on any of my stories.
Well, maybe you should take a lesson from that.
But I think, like, the story gets to, you know, the hacking doesn't need to have. You don't need to make the argument that the hacking flipped the election to make the argument that it's serious and an enormous problem.
But then why are the electors demanding a briefing on it, if not for to determine whether it changed the outcome of the vote?
Well, right. And so now we're getting into kind of the political strategy of this, as opposed to the, you know, objective analysis that people turn to Nerdcast for.
Before we leave this topic, though, let's talk about the Clinton campaign strategy here. They actually didn't have to say anything about Russia. And it was just a few days ago that, you know, Clinton's former campaign chiefs started coming out of the woodwork and supporting this idea that the CIA floated last week, tying the hacks directly to Moscow. What was the political calculation? Why get involved in that when you already had Republican members of Congress siding against Trump on this issue?
I don't know if it's a political calculation. I think it's a personal calculation. It's a legacy calculation. Like, these people were running the most shocking campaign loss of all time. And if I were them, I would be looking for kind of some deus ex machina explanation to explain it instead of. And our own Isaac Dover had a great story this week on Michigan and the Clinton campaign's kind of failure to perform there that speaks to a lot of the other types of problems that were going on, these strategy problems, the kind of lack of communication,
tactical problems
with ground forces, with labor allies, and so on and so forth. But and so, you know, obviously there was a lot of that going on, but I think there's a human impulse here, apart from any, you know, kind of cold political calculation, to pin this on something besides themselves.
And they've been looking for that thing. And right after the election, famously at that Harvard symposium that featured a lot of fireworks, they hung it very much on the Comey letter. They basically traced the loss directly to the Comey letter. That, even though, as we discussed, there was actually polling that suggests that did have an impact in a very discernible way at a very precise and important time, I still think that was a bridge too far. And this is another example of them looking for something else on which to blame the law.
I think the Comey letter is a much more reasonable explanation for them to hand there.
Still reasonable, but also not, you know, no evidence of it being determinative. This is even more tenuous.
Ken, I disagree with you on this point. I mean, I think in general, the Clinton campaign would be better served by owning up to all the ways in which they fell short in this campaign and not constantly be searching for, oh, it was Comey, it was Russia, and all these things. I think they all played a factor, but we're not seeing a whole lot of introspection about, at least publicly, about why they lost and the ways they fell short in their message and their candidate and their strategy. But having said all that, I think the Clinton campaign has been extremely responsible in how they've approached these questions after the election. They did not weigh in at all on the business of recounts. You know, they conceded, Hillary Clinton conceded that same night. They were very cognizant, I think, and showed it in many ways while the rest of the party was pulling out their hair and raising questions about the president-elect's legitimacy. You did not hear any of that coming from the Clinton camp. They were very cautious, and they were cautious when they finally did put a little toe in the water in terms of the recounts. All they said was, we're monitoring, which is totally reasonable. So I think it's important to give them credit there.
I agree, and I think they have been responsible, but I don't think that is mutually exclusive with them looking from a personal perspective for something to blame from a legacy, you know, from the perspective of like preserving their legacy or at least minimizing the damage to it. The more puzzling thing, though, to me was Donald Trump coming out and blasting these conclusions by the CIA that Russia was involved, that Russia not only perpetrated the hack, but that Russia perpetrated the hack to favor him, calling it ridiculous and kind of discouraging Congress from launching any kind of formal probe. That to me was puzzling. He should have just sat back, because I think that no matter what these probes find, as I suggested, and as my assessment of the poll numbers show, they are not going to be able to definitively link his victory to these things. So just let it play out and step back. Don't be like goaded, but he seems to be like constitutionally incapable of not taking the bait.
Well, what has happened in the last year and a half that would have convinced him not to follow his instincts and just tweet when he feels like?
The bigger problem is it just like, Ken's point, it belies a level of personal insecurity that is below the office. You know, I mean, why even weigh in at all? I don't think it undermines his legitimacy as the president-elect at all. These are very serious questions, and they should be answered, and they can't just be brushed aside.
I mean, the only reason why he would have cause to be concerned about these inquiries is if there were some evidence that could be unearthed that would definitively link his campaign or his allies to the hacking, either through Roger Stone or something else. I haven't seen that, but if that were out there and it could be shown that he or the folks at the highest levels of his operation knew what was going on and either failed to blow the whistle or even encouraged it, then that would be deeply, deeply damaging of his presidency.
Let's talk transition and welcome back our wonderful transition reporter, Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
The dominant Nancy Cook.
I like that, Ken. Thanks for having me.
All right. Data point 3, the number of Senate Republicans already expressing concern about Rex Tillerson's ties to Russia. Now, we started to talk about this a little bit earlier, but we were disciplined and we stopped ourselves because we wanted you to come in here and tell our listeners, please, who is Rex Tillerson and what the hell is the problem?
Sure. So he is a 64-year-old CEO of ExxonMobil. He's worked for the company his whole career. And so he's really this huge business executive, someone who Trump really likes and sees as a peer, but he's also going to be the next Secretary of State, provided that he sails through confirmation. The thing that a lot of Senate Republicans are raising questions about is that during his tenure as the ExxonMobil CEO, he had really strong ties to Russia, which he really had to have for a business perspective. And that dates back to the 90s. He knows Vladimir Putin. He knows people who run Russian oil companies. And so he really runs with this circle of business and political elite in Russia. And there are a bunch of Republicans like Senator Lindsey Graham, Senator John McCain, and Marco Rubio who are raising real questions about, should we have the Secretary of State be so cozy with the Russian government?
On top of that, we've got Trump officials on television, or at least on Twitter, in the last few days talking about, or at least raising the possibility that Trump would unwind sanctions against Russia.
Yeah, so We're setting up a real major early flashpoint here, I think, between the Trump Republican Party and the traditional Republican Party, as represented by the sort of the national security conservative wing, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Marco Rubio being leading members of that. They are all on the record advocating for stricter sanctions. They are all on the record expressing concern about the hacking and support for a congressional inquiry into the hacking. And they have all expressed reservations about Tillerson. On all three of those points, they are out. They are sort of out of step with Trump. And I think that we could see the Tillerson, potentially all three of those related to Russia, but the Tillerson nomination in particular, become the first real test of whether Republicans are going to be willing to stand up to Donald Trump and to stand up for sort of more traditional parts of the Republican Party orthodoxy, or whether they're going to fold. Now, let's take those three. Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio obviously ran against Trump, had a lot of nasty things to say about him during the campaign, and then sort of backpedaled away from it and came to a place where they were sort of comfortable with varying degrees of expressing varying degrees of support for Trump. McCain, you could say the same thing about, except he didn't run against him. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they're going to have the spine. The one who I think to watch most is John McCain, probably not going to run for re-election. I think a lot of people are expecting a return of the maverick, just don't give a you-know-what John McCain, who is willing to challenge his own party on things like, you know, you wouldn't think he would have to challenge on Russia, but on things like Russia, on things like climate change, campaign finance reform, immigration reform, places where he was really out of step with his party. I think we might see a return of that John McCain, and that could be a real thorn in Donald Trump's side.
Yeah, I suspect he gets some serious questions from some heavyweight senators. So, you know, that he's not going to skate through the nomination. But ultimately, I just don't see enough potential resistance out there because, number one, he's a Texan. And I think that's really important. I mean, you're talking about the biggest House delegation in the Republican conference there. You're talking about possibly the most important state in the Republican universe. That all helps. But also keep in mind, I could easily envision a scenario where we get some tough questions from those folks, but they're also in political terms easily dismissed. And I emphasize in political terms, they are easily dismissed because he just goes before them, shows some contrition maybe, and then talks about, you know, his answers would be something like, I was merely acting in the service of my fiduciary responsibilities to shareholders. Those were not always a reflection of my personal views and personal relationships. And I think ultimately that probably carries the day with a number of senators.
Nancy, jump in here. This was an interesting cabinet choice, not least for the name that Trump ultimately landed on, but the process by which he got there. For weeks, we had been watching the Secretary of State deliberations almost in real time, right? And so many names went in and out. And suddenly, there was Rex. And he was the last name any of us heard, and he suddenly emerged as the winner. How did that happen?
Well, it was so funny because even a few days ago or before he was announced, you know, I talked to a transition official who said, oh, yeah, you know, he just came by Trump Tower, but, you know, he's not going to be the Secretary of State. You know, it's like-minded CEOs meeting. And I think that it just, you know, I my sense of reporting on the transition is just that the people who meet with Trump last always sort of leave the best impression on him. And so I feel like Trump hadn't necessarily landed on someone that he felt really comfortable with for Secretary of State, you know, who went through Mitt Romney, he went through Senator Bob Corker, you know, General Petraeus. And I feel like these two had a real chemistry in terms of that they were both business people. You know, Trump really admires the global CEO portfolio. And I think that, you know, he met him and there wasn't a lot of vetting and it happened quickly and there we are.
What do you think the role, Ken, was of Bob Gates and Condoleezza Rice?
Yeah, I mean, we heard that Bob Gates not only went to bat for Tillerson, as did Condoleezza Rice, and that their respective firms had actually done business with ExxonMobil. So people raised questions about their motivation. I don't know that we can necessarily impugn their motives for going to bat for them, but certainly, there are significant people, and we'd also heard that Gates is not necessarily a huge fan of Petraeus, so there's that, too. You know, I think something that Nancy mentioned is really interesting. I think we've seen this dynamic sort of play out on multiple decisions, and it's the idea that, like, whoever talks to Trump last is the one who carries the day. And the reason why I think this is so significant, or certainly one of the reasons why it is one of the reasons why we're seeing such a pitched battle among his top aides and allies about who gets these pivotal White House jobs, because whoever is going to be there last, first of all, whoever Trump sees the most and talks to the most is going to have a good chance of shaping his ultimate decision, and particularly whoever talks to him last. And so we see a pitch battle between Reince Priebus and his allies, and sort of the Republican Party establishment, and Steve Bannon and his allies in sort of the Donald Trump loyalist anti-establishment camp, to get as many of their folks into these key offices as possible. We're waiting right now on a number of appointments to the senior White House staff, but from what we've heard, Reince Priebus so far and his allies appear to be getting more of these plum gigs.
One thing that I would be curious just to hear from all of you that I've been wondering about is who will face the toughest confirmation battle with the Senate. You know, I would have thought that it was Steve Mnuchin before for Treasury, just given some of his foreclosure problems, or he founded a mortgage company that screwed a lot of average Americans financially. But, you know, now we have Tillerson. Like, I'm curious what you all think.
It's interesting, given that Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker are now making their way into some foreign policy posts in the Senate. And what is their end game? Are they positioning themselves for simply fighting confirmation, or is there something bigger there? Ken, what's your take?
2020, as far as Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, I mean, they're both, Elizabeth Warren in particular is someone who didn't really have a lot of foreign policy experience and bona fides. And when she was discussed as a possible vice presidential candidate with Hillary Clinton, that was regarded as one of her weaknesses. So certainly by getting a post on the Armed Services Committee, she not only has the potential to burnish her foreign policy and military policy bona fides, but she puts herself right in the middle of the confirmation fight for Mattis as Secretary of Defense. She puts herself right in the middle of potential investigation into the Russian hacking. You know, so I think that that has a lot of 2020 implications there. The one interesting caveat that I would add on her in particular is that, you know, liberals are so excited about her because she's a champion of the sort of economic populism of the Bernie Sanders variety, and is in a place on those issues that has the most energy in the Democratic coalition. But I think they might be surprised on foreign policy from what the little that she's been out there. She's kind of hawkish. She's probably closer to Hillary Clinton on some of these issues like Israel and Palestine. And, you know, she's brought home the bacon to defense contractors in Massachusetts. And so it's it could take a little bit of the luster off her, I think.
You know what Democrats need? They need an old white lady.
There you go. Well, to be fair, though, she, I believe, would be 71, I think, on election day in 2020. Donald Trump would be 74. So she's still younger than him.
Let's get to the last segment. The data point is 4. And that's the number of 2018 Senate races already affected by the Trump cabinet shuffle. Scott, walk us through it.
Yeah, so big developments in one of them just this week. So Congressman Ryan Zinke, the Republican from Montana, has been tapped to lead the Interior Department. And this is big because Republicans have been not just hoping, but kind of counting on him for much of the past year to run against Democratic Senator John Tester in 2018. And this more or less forecloses on the possibility of him doing that. You know, the nature of Senate races these days, there really are close to 2-year events with, you know, maybe one or two exceptions every election cycle. But, you know, him going to lead a federal agency would really take him out of contention.
So
for
why
that.
Did Reince let this happen?
Well, so we Kevin Robillard had some really interesting backstory on this, that a Tester ally had the ear of Donald Trump Jr., who was very involved in this process and was pushing Zinke and kind of beating up a little bit on Kathy McMorris Rodgers, who was the other House Republican who was in the running for this. And this is the leader of a group called Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, of which Donald Trump Jr. has been a longtime member. It was very critical of McMorris Rodgers and very supportive of Zinke on public land issues. Now, the thing is, this group, a super PAC and nonprofit affiliated with this group, spent millions of dollars getting Tester elected, reelected in 2012. And in fact, that time they also boosted a potential opponent of his in order to ultimately help him. They ran ads backing the Libertarian in that Senate race, calling him the true conservative to siphon votes away from the Republican who was Tester's primary challenger. So again, you know, we're seeing this in our reporting, this kind of, well, I don't know, a little bit of a conspiracy, basically, it looks like, to maybe try and get Zinke out of the way.
What are the other races?
Yeah, so there are two other, there are two Democratic senators who have been talked about for Trump cabinet positions. There's Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who has put the kibosh on it. He said that he's going to be staying in the Senate. And then there's Heidi Heitkamp out of North Dakota, who's been to Trump Tower, had meetings, has talked about, you know, being considered for this. You know, again, she has not taken herself out of consideration the way Manchin has. But, you know, both of them, if she doesn't end up doing it, she, like Manchin, has spent the last couple weeks kind of wringing really positive quotes out of the Trump transition team, the people who are going to be the top Republicans in the country for the next few years, as she gets ready to run for reelection in a state that voted for Trump by massive margins in 2016. So she's going to be able to say, look, they love me. You know, you should what better cross-party endorsement could you ask for? And then the last Senate race we should mention is not a battleground the way those other three are going to be in 2018, but Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General designate, has spent the last 20 years as the junior senator from Alabama and is going to be giving up his seat, assuming he's confirmed. And so there's obviously probably a lot of pent up ambition in the state, kind of waiting for one of those seats to come open. And we've already seen a few different people put their names forward. The state attorney general has already said he's going to run in 2018 when the seat's up in a special election. The reason he said he's going to run as opposed to putting his name forward for an appointment is because he's currently investigating the governor who makes the appointment. And so he's probably not going to get that one, but he's gearing up for a run at the seat himself.
I love Alabama politics. Charlie, jump in here. When you look at these Senate races and you consider what Trump is doing, I'm going to put the same question to you. Why would Reince Priebus let some of these things happen? He's a smart dude.
Well, I mean, I don't think Reince necessarily is calling the shots in the same capacity that he once was. I imagine the you know, he's got bigger fish to fry these days. But what I've been watching and been very curious about is who initiated the Manchin and Heitkamp discussions. Mm-hmm. Did that come from those senators themselves who reached out to Trump Tower and said, hey, can we take a meeting? Or did it come from the Trump inner circle? And the reason I think this is because we did not see a whole lot of high-end political strategery coming from the Trump inner circle during the campaign. I mean, the guy won, yes, but let's face it, you know, they caught lightning in a bottle. He was a unique candidate, and that campaign won solely on the broad shoulders of Donald Trump, not because there was a mastermind in the back room working, you know, working their political magic. The only real innovation that came out of that campaign came out of the digital side and out of probably Brad Parscale. And that wasn't really necessarily, you know, any innovative political gaming right there. So I guess this is a long way of saying it would have been a very smart move for the Trump people to go to two red state Democrats with a lot to be scared of when they're on the ballot in 2018, and to try and establish a relationship and establish some goodwill by bringing them in and talking to them before the administration starts. And it also would have been a smart move to just appoint them to the cabinet, because it would have sent a message to the American people that he will work across partisan lines. And it would have worked to their interests just to have that meeting back home, because it would tell their constituents that, hey, you know, Senator Manchin or Senator Heitkamp will work with a Republican president. So this was something that the Obama administration did early on by plucking Republicans for various spots and creating vacancies that Democrats ultimately won. So if that's what was going on at Trump Tower, then I give them credit.
Yeah, just two things to pivot off of what Charlie said. One is that, you know, this isn't necessarily a new tradition of, you know, one party plucking a member from another party for a cabinet post. I mean, Obama tried to poach Judd Gregg of New Hampshire back in 2008, and Gregg ended up pulling out. But I feel like there is some precedent for people reaching across the aisle to fill some of these slots. And then, two, the other thing with the Senate races is I do just feel like, as I'm talking to people about the confirmation battles and some of the policy fights that we're going to have in next year, so much of it and all of these, the politicking around it, is already focused on 2018, you know, trying to get people on the record about how they, where they stand on tax reform or Obamacare, or even, you know, who's going to be helpful and who's going to try to block nominations for the Attorney General or the Treasury Secretary. You know, all of the political strategy around this, at least with the people I speak to, is really around 2018. And I think that that's interesting, that while the rest of the country is still wondering what a Trump presidency is going to look like and what will the inauguration even look like, everyone in Washington is already looking ahead to the midterms.
I think that's a great point, Nancy. I mean, this is interesting, but it really doesn't change the fundamentals of the difficult situation facing Democrats in 18, right?
No. I mean, it's going to be hugely difficult. And we've run through the numbers a little bit before. You know, there are 10 Democratic senators from Trump states who are up for re-election in 2018, and five of those who are in, you know, really super red states, you know, a lot of the ones that we've mentioned so far. And those senators in particular, the ones from the West Virginias and the North Dakotas of the world, are going to have a really tough time no matter what. And I think that's why you see them focusing on this so early and, you know, maybe trying to bank some of that inter-party praise and trying to get their name out there and on, you know, working with some of Trump's nominees in some sense, and then taking a very hard line against maybe one, two, or three of them, depending on the issues that come up, whether it's Medicare or Wall Street or any other issue.
All right, that's it for us, and it's time for me to say my last goodbyes to our Nerdcast team. Goodbye, Charlie Mattesian.
Kristen, this is so sad. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Ken Vogel.
Kristen, it has been a pleasure working with you and doing this Nerdcast, and we are excited to see what you do next.
Thank you, Ken. Bye, Scott Bland.
Bye, Kristen. Thanks for everything.
And Nancy Cook, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. This is our second job that we worked at together in Washington, so I'm sure our paths will cross again.
That's Washington. So as you can tell, this was my last Nerdcast, and you'll have a new host next week. And I want to take a moment to extend my very sincere thanks to all of our listeners. You've provided valuable feedback to this team, and you've helped make this show better really every single week. All the Nerdcasters appreciate your questions, and I personally appreciate both the praise and the criticism that you've sent our way. I hope you'll keep listening to Nerdcast. I know that I certainly will. So for the last time, let me thank our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Kookman, and our researcher and my one-time secret intern, Zach Montalaro. And again, and of course, thank you to you, our listeners. Talk to you soon.